Good evening, everyone. I thank you for opening up your schedules and coming along with me tonight. And I also want to welcome all those who will be watching these evening programs for the mission live streaming. I am always happy to come to Loretto, as like I mentioned in the homily over the course of the weekend. Even though COVID has significantly restricted my travel back and forth, I travel enough to know that there are parishes in the nation that have a wonderful, wonderful sense of community with great musicians and lectors and singers and certainly participation on the part of the congregation. And Loretto is one of those parishes. I'm not playing to my audience, but you need to know this. And I'm always delighted when Father David invites me to come back and be with you. We begin tonight this week of parish mission, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. As you heard me say over the weekend, there is a presentation in the morning, simply the presentation after the 7:30 Mass, roughly at 8:30. So this reflection that I'm offering for your consideration this evening was also given to a large group of people here this morning. And we will follow that procedure so that you can choose maybe tomorrow. The morning is better than the evening, so you can continue with me through the course of the mission by choosing which time frame, morning or evening, is best for you. The other thing that I would want to mention before we dive into some substantive material tonight is that these topics and the parish mission always centers on a theme or on a topic, which enables someone like myself to collect my thinking, organize my thinking around a particular topic, and then evening by evening open that topic up and look at slices or angles or dimensions of the topic. And I choose these topics, and I'm grateful because once again here at Loretto, rather than telling me what the topic should be and what they want me to address, they've always been kind enough to allow me to select my own theme and my own topic, which is often not the case. I am often told by parishes, we want you to address this topic or that topic, and so it gives me a great deal of personal freedom. And the topics that I share with you in these parish missions, and this is the third time now that we will be together, they are based upon my conversations with people around the country, often people sitting next to me on a plane, who, when they find out that I'm a Catholic priest, panic, many of them. But and I know that they cannot spend the whole flight in the restroom, so they have to deal with me, and it's an opportunity for me to listen to people. This is one of the great gifts that Pope Francis has reminded us about. We don't want to come into conversations with already prearranged ideas and statements that we're going to make, even if they're irrelevant to the topic. Francis says that when we enter into a conversation with another person, we have to develop what he calls a culture of encounter. And that means that we listen to the other person and we share with the other person, not trying in any way, shape, or form to convince them one way or the other. And I have learned a great deal. Sometimes people sitting next to me on the plane will say, I used to be a Catholic, I used to go to church, but I don't do that anymore. And I discover in the course of this conversation that they have no deep-seated hatred of God, and no deep-seated disregard for the Catholic Church, but these are people who have three jobs and four jobs. They have kids that have to be educated, bills that have to be paid, there has to be food on the table, and as would be the case with anybody, there is a drift and a wider drift, and suddenly people discover that they're no longer going to church at all. But fundamentally, it's not based on rejection, but on the necessities of life. And when I discover in these encounters with people, that's where they're coming from, I do not miss an opportunity to invite them to reconsider coming back to the community, participating in the religious life of their parish, and so forth. But in the course of these conversations, as I listen, I hear certain themes, I hear certain insights, and they seem to repeat themselves in the multiple conversations that I have with people. And when I listen and recognize these themes, then I sit down and I begin to construct four evenings of reflection, fundamentally based in the scriptures, because that is the document of faith. And everything needs to be seen through the truths of the scriptures. And then, depending on what the topic is, I borrow ideas from the wisdom community, namely the saints, and the wonderful writings that they have left behind. And if I discover in these conversations that this individual I'm speaking with is in some kind of a recovery program, struggling with alcoholism or drug addiction or pornography or whatever their particular addiction might be, then I use the material of 12-step programs, which is a rich and beautiful form of spirituality, and a spirituality that speaks into the lives of millions and millions of people all over the globe. So the topic that I have chosen to reflect with you about this week is this fundamental call to live a virtuous life. And we find that this is not just a Christian consideration. You can go back into the writings of some of the ancient Greek philosophers, not the least of which would be Aristotle, in his famous book, The Nicomachean Ethics, where he talks about living a life of integrity, a life of honesty, a life of decency, these virtues, so that when we pass through the journey of life, we leave behind, hopefully to God, a better life, especially for the people that are coming behind us, and a better appreciation of the resources of the earth, which we must always respect and use frugally and carefully because of the generations that are coming behind us. And so this week, I want to reflect with you about this call to a virtuous way of life. And in the course of the week, we're going to be looking at eight fundamental virtues. I know that that is not an exhaustive list. We could have God knows how many parish missions exploring even further and further than eight, but we're going to scatter these eight fundamental virtues through the course of Monday tonight, Tuesday and Wednesday, and then on Thursday evening, I want to invite you to look with me at the two pillars of the two institutions, namely marriage and family life. These are the two pillars, these are the two institutions that basically are schools where we learn the kind of virtues and the living of these virtues, so that there is a better world as a result of our efforts to live a virtuous life. We're going to deal with love tonight because that is the fundamental virtue of all of them. But before we take up that individual virtue, I want to just make mention of the fact that this call to a virtuous way of life is not just to be done on a personal and individual level, but this has got to be also recognized as a call to the community of the church, or even wider, to the community of a nation. I don't say that off the cuff, because those of you in my generation who might have studied as youngsters from the Baltimore Catechism, and every country had one of these catechisms, they are the fruit of a very important council in the 15th and 16th century, namely the Council of Trent. The Irish had something called the Archbishop Powers Catechism. The Italian people had something called the Bellarmino Catechism, written by Robert Bellarmine. And in our country here, the bishops gathered in 1863 in Baltimore. Imagine if they would have gathered here in Foxfield. You would be famous all over the world because of the Foxfield Catechism. But they commissioned a team of theologians to come up with a relatively simple black and white explanation of the Catholic faith, and they wanted it to be simple, not because people were stupid, but because the literacy rate in the United States in 1863 was incredibly low. You would find, for example, in our church here tonight, if we were outside of COVID, a packed community of people at any given Mass, and the combined levels of education of all the people gathered here for a Sunday morning Mass would far exceed the level of education that you would have found in a packed cathedral in 1863. And so these catechisms that proliferated around the world, we learned as kids from the Baltimore Catechism, and the Baltimore Catechism tells us that there are 2 days of judgment. There's a day of individual judgment that you and I, at the end of our own personal journey, will stand before God, and we will have to give an accounting as to how we have lived this virtuous life, that we will have to indicate by our behavior and so forth the choice that we would have made based in the grace of our baptism to become a better person, a holier person down through the journey of our life. There is a day of individual judgment, and we will all be subjected to that experience. But then, the Baltimore Catechism tells us there is a second day of judgment, and this is based upon the 25th chapter of St. Matthew's Gospel, where we are told that at the end of the world, all the nations of the world will be brought before God, and each individual nation will have to give an accounting of itself as to how it has used its resources and so forth to better the lives of other people, to care for the things that were important, so that the whole global community can benefit. And we will have to give an accounting as a nation. It's right there in Matthew 25. And on that day, you and I, for example, as Americans, or if we are French or Spanish or German or from Nigeria or whatever, every individual nation will have to give an accounting of itself. And in our case, we cannot stand before God on the day of that general judgment and say, this president made me do it, this president made me do it, because we elect these people. And we put them into positions of enormous power. And they speak and act on our behalf. And therefore, there is a day of judgment in terms of the nation. So I don't want anyone here tonight in the church or anyone watching this on live stream television thinking that this is all just about me. It is not just about me, although I have to live a virtuous life, but so does the nation. And on the basis of that, I think we have to appreciate the fact that individuals like you and me, as well as whole nations, can drift away from the living of a virtuous way of life. And we have to remember a number of things about the greatness of our own country and the challenge that as this country has been graced by God with so much resources and so much intelligence and so much giftedness, that is to be shared, that is to be offered to the rest of the world. And at the end of the world, when you and I as Americans stand before God, we're going to have to answer some questions if that has not been the way we've lived our lives as a nation. Because this is a very, very great and important nation. I began to write these talks for this particular parish mission on the virtuous life, if you can believe this, almost 20 years ago, as a result of 9/11. At that point in time, my schedule was filled with a lot of military engagements. Although I'm not military myself, I was invited to speak on American army bases and military bases around the world. And on that particular day, 9/11, I was in a small American army base at Gießen in Germany. There was a potluck supper planned, and all of the families and myself were gathered in a particular farmhouse waiting for the soldiers to come and join us. And as the afternoon went on and on, the soldiers were not appearing. And then one soldier came in a jeep and said, "No one's coming, turn on the television." And there before us were the Twin Towers crumbling. There before us was the horrors of the plane crash in Pennsylvania and into the Pentagon and the loss of thousands and thousands of lives. Almost immediately, at least in Germany, they positioned waist-high pylons shaped like triangles, filled with cement in front of the gates of these various army bases, so that if anyone was on that base and having done mischief was trying to get off or were planning it on there to do mischief, they were going to have to negotiate these waist-high pylons. And they set these things up, and this is what I want to share with you about the greatness of this country. Not to give us inflated egos, but simply to appreciate who we are and what we stand for. Within an hour of those pylons being placed in front of those gates, I saw this. Old German people came out to those pylons, and without saying a word, they left tiny bouquets of flowers on top of the pylons. They left candles, little tiny lit candles. And they also left behind very faded American flags that didn't have all the stars, because they saved them from the Second World War, and they were expressing their solidarity with us because those old German people have never forgotten all that America did after the destruction of the Third Reich to help them rebuild their lives. We need to hear this and the perceptions of people from outside of us so that we appreciate the challenge individually and as a nation to claim again and again and again this life of virtue, because this is truly a gifted and graced nation. And I wouldn't even stop with those old German people. I would turn to a very important gentleman, a Frenchman, a minor aristocrat, who came to this country in the 19th century to analyze the American prison system. They did not want to continue the inhumanity that was present in, say, the Bastille. After the French Revolution, they were trying to create a more humane penal system, prison system, and so they sent this gentleman by the name of Alexis de Tocqueville. He was here in this country for the better part of 2 years, traveling the nation, as it was at that time, the United States. And he did this quite frequently in other countries. He would travel to these foreign countries and then come back to his apartment in Paris and sit down and write memoirs of what he had seen and observed. And he did this when he went home to Paris after having been here with us for over 2 years. He sat down and he wrote one of the most important books that has ever been written about this country. And I would ask you, somewhere along the line, to get a copy of this particular book. It is a very difficult and hard read, but it's an important piece of literature. It's called Democracy in America. This is a significant book, an analysis in the 19th century of what this Frenchman, Alexis de Tocqueville, saw in spending time among us. And this is what Alexis de Tocqueville said. He said, many, many glowing things, many positive things about our country. He said, never in all of my world travels have I come upon a group of people like these Americans. They are so energetic and so enthusiastic. Never have I come upon a group of these people like the Americans who were so brave in pushing horizons and pushing frontiers as pioneers. Never have I seen a group of people like these Americans so energized about life and willing to tackle even very difficult situations. He said amazingly positive, appreciative statements about our country and about the American people. But then, to be balanced, you turn the page. And he said some things about us that we might not like to hear, but we need to hear, because some of the things that he said about us in the 19th century are still present in our nation this evening. What did he say? He said, never have I come upon a group of people who are so easily seduced by trends and fads and passing fancies. Never have I come upon a group of people who are so easily satisfied with the most facile answers to the great, great questions of life. And he said one of the most maddening things about these Americans, and you've already proven this not to be the case, but he said one of the maddening things about these Americans, you cannot get them to sit still for 20 minutes and listen to anything intelligent. I mention Alexis de Tocqueville because he has something to say to us, because as a nation gifted and graced as we are, we can become caught up in the frivolous and the superficial and the meaninglessness of all kinds of trends and fads and lose ourselves. This was an observation not made by Simeon Gallagher. It was made about us by a 19th century French philosopher, Alexis de Tocqueville, and I call that book to your attention, Democracy in America. You can find it in any decent bookstore this evening. And if you don't mind, I want to add another voice that tells us in an appreciative fashion about ourselves. As you know, the Vatican City is an independent, recognized state in its own accord. Consequently, because it is an independent state, it has the privilege of assigning ambassadors to various capitals around the world. And we don't call them ambassadors, we call them papal nuncios. It's a Latin word meaning messenger. And we've had a number of these gentlemen assigned here to the United States down through the years, but there was one gentleman in particular that I want to call to your attention. He was an Italian archbishop, a papal diplomat, whose career spanned an assignment in Cameroon in West Africa. He was assigned, if I'm not mistaken, for a significant period of time to India. He was also the papal nuncio to Argentina in Latin America, specifically during the military junta that ruled that country, and from there he was sent to the United States. His name was Pio Laghi. He was with us in this country for a long period of time. There was a young priest in the papal embassy, or nunciature as they call it in Washington, and they didn't know when he was going to arrive to begin his work. He hadn't told them his schedule. And so this young priest, Timothy Dolan, who's now the Cardinal Archbishop of New York, he was a priest ordained for service in St. Louis, Missouri. And I lived for 27 years in St. Louis. And so I wouldn't say we're the best of buddies, but we have a conversational level between the two of us. And he told me that no one at the embassy knew when Pio Laghi was appearing, so Timothy got up early one morning, went down to put breakfast foods out, put a pot of coffee on, should the Archbishop come in the early part of the morning, and lo and behold, when he went downstairs into the public areas of the embassy, he discovered that Archbishop Laghi was already up in his pajamas and bathrobe, with a cup of espresso that he had made for himself in his hand, looking through the Venetian blinds out onto Massachusetts Avenue, where these embassies, for the most part, are located, and the traffic, and it was 3 o'clock in the morning, 4 o'clock, rushing, rushing, rushing on Massachusetts Avenue. And he said to Father Dolan, "Where are all these people going? It's 4 o'clock in the morning." He said, "Archbishop, they're going to work." He said, "Some of them are coming in from the distant suburbs in Maryland and Virginia. And if they're not high-level echelon people who have their own parking space, they need to find a parking space because they're supposed to be at their desks at 6 o'clock in the morning." He said, "They're going to work." Pio Laghi was with us for a number of years, and in those years, he traversed the nation, establishing new dioceses and consecrating new bishops and blessing all kinds of new building. He had a pretty good handle on America. And after a number of years, he was recalled to Rome. He was put in charge of the Congregation for Catholic Education, and he was made a cardinal. But before he left to go to Rome, he asked a group of wealthy Catholic businessmen in Detroit to give him all of the equipment that he needed to set up his office in the Vatican according to an American business model, because in all the years he was with us, he noticed the efficiency with which we do things, and that we're not afraid to get up early in the morning, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the morning, the traffic on Massachusetts, we're not afraid to get up and go to work, that there is a kind of determination, almost a courageous determination, to tackle the tasks of the day. He was so impressed by the American efficiency that he wanted his office in Rome to be constructed on an American business model. And Timothy Dolan said to me, "Simeon, it's the only office in the Vatican that's really working." I mentioned these three things: the old German people, Alexis de Tocqueville, and then, of course, Pio Laghi, a diplomat who had seen the world, who make observations about us as a country, as a nation, so that we know that fundamentally, even though we've got struggles and problems, and we're very caught up in all combative kinds of discussions, etc., we are still a very good people and a very generous people. If we are not the first responders, we are among the first responders to every tragedy and every catastrophe that hits the human community. This is not to make us haughty and to make us prideful. It's to situate us with the gifts and the graces and the talents that we have been given and what we're doing with these in order to better the world in which we live. And when you stop and think about this, let me push this one step further. When you stop and look at that constellation of people who were present at the beginning of our nation's history, the level of brilliance, the level of commitment, and so forth, you will not find that kind of a constellation of brilliance and so forth at the beginning of any modern nation in the face of the world this evening. When you go back and look at the incredible intelligence of people like Thomas Jefferson, granted he was hugely compromised on the slave issue, but if you've been to his estate in the hills of Northern Virginia, outside of Washington, at Monticello, go into that building and go into the library. This is a man in the 17th century. He read extensively in mathematics, history, geography, extensively in philosophy and in religion. He represented our country at the court of the King of France before the French Revolution. And they had intellectual salons in Paris where the brilliant people of France came on a Wednesday evening and discussed these high-level kinds of ideas and topics. And Thomas Jefferson participated in those intellectual salons. If Mensa, that organization for super brainy people that we now have, if that was around in the 17th century, Thomas Jefferson would have been the president of Mensa. Brilliant, brilliant man. When he effected the Louisiana Purchase, which is the glowing contribution of his administration as president, he commissioned Lewis and Clark to find a waterway to the west. They left from St. Charles, Missouri, outside of St. Louis, to begin this long journey. And he said, "You are going to see species of animals and flowers and so forth." And he said, "I want you to box these up and send them back to me here in Washington." He had never been out there, but he knew what was out there. You know why? Because he read the Indian skins. The Indian, the Native American people, had a form of hieroglyphics like the Egyptians. and they wrote on the backs of skins. And Thomas Jefferson got himself a copy of the skins of the Native American people and learned how to read the hieroglyphics, and they found exactly what he told them was out there, and they sent it back to him, and that became ultimately the foundation of the Smithsonian Institution. The only thing he wanted to be remembered for, even though he wrote the Declaration of Independence, which would be enough, the only thing he wanted to be remembered for was that he was the founder of the University of Virginia, and he's buried on the campus. No huge presidential library and all those things that we now expect to be built. A simple little burial site. He wanted to be buried in the midst of an intellectual community, an intellectual academic community. And he's buried. Look at John and Abigail Adams. People of incredible moral rectitude. He was also the American minister to the court of France, and he was over in France for a number of years while Abigail was raising their kids on a farm outside of Boston. And we know all that transpired because of the correspondence that went on between the two of them. And when his work in Paris was finished, he came back and landed in the Boston Harbor, got into a carriage, and went for two more years down to Philadelphia to participate in the Constitutional Congress. And in those years that that couple were separated, you will not find a single moment of marital infidelity. These were people, foundational people, of incredible integrity, people who lived a virtuous life. And let's remember this. Had that revolution not been successful, every single one of these people would have been hung by the British government as traitors. And they had an awful lot to lose. Benjamin Franklin, the wealthiest man in the colonies. He had all these patents for inventions. And so he was the one who established the Philadelphia Free Library and the University of Pennsylvania. His son never bought the revolutionary ideals of his father. The English king made his son the governor of New Jersey. And when the revolution was successful, the son went back to England, became some kind of a minor diplomat in the machinery of the British government, and the father and the son never talked to each other again. Enormous sacrifices were made by these people who were the foundation stones of our nation. I'm not saying this to bloat us and fill us with all kind of nationalistic pride. I'm simply mentioning all these examples because we are a gifted and graced country, a gifted and graced people. And it's always a possibility, a terrible possibility, that as you and I can drift away from a virtuous way of life, so can the nation. And if I could push again a little bit further, if these people came back and moved among us tonight in 2020, would they see the realization of the visions and the dreams that they had for this country when they were working in the 17th century? If they came back and moved among us tonight, this is what they would find. And as I said, I began to write these conferences for this particular parish mission 20 years ago, and I have collected tidbits from magazines and books and so forth all the way through those 20 years. If they came back, what would they discover tonight? That we have become a contentious society, engaged in so many cases in useless litigations, suing each other. They would come back to discover that street gangs are proliferating all over the nation, providing a sense of belonging for kids whose family lives have been destroyed, even though their sense of belonging is going to turn them in a negative direction. They would come back to discover that the private lives of our public officials are not to be considered in any way, shape, or form consequential into the way we elect them. They would come back to discover that gambling has become a means to recoup undisciplined and flagrant spending in our public officials. They would come back to discover that work, which was once considered a blessing, is now considered a burden. You go over here to one of these malls and you want to buy a blouse or a shirt, and you take it up to the counter, and the person behind the counter is on the phone setting up a date for the coming weekend, and you and I are an inconvenience to their social calendar. They would come back to discover that millions of people are in prison, and we're building even more of these prisons. They would discover that the nation is being sapped of its energy by pornography and drugs. I am not a pessimist. In fact, the friars at the house where I live make fun of me because they think I'm a cockeyed optimist. And I am, in many ways. For me, the glass is always half full and not half empty. But when you go back and look at these statistics, if these people that founded the nation came back and looked at what has happened in the number of years we've been a country, they would realize that individually and as a nation, we have drifted. And that's this idea of a virtuous way of life. If I were to propose to you tonight, why has all of this happened down through the history of our country? And I suppose people would expect me as a priest to say this, but I would say this even if I wasn't a priest. We have become so saturated with secularism and secularism and secularism. And what does that mean? That this is the only reality, and this idea of a transcendent God and a transcendent world toward which we are all moving, and we are meant by God's plan to be together with Him forever. He doesn't want any of us to be lost. But the fact of the matter is, this secularism has robbed us of a sense of God's presence. And it's only when God's presence is realized that the desire and the hunger for holiness and the desire and hunger to live a good life becomes predominant. And it's possible that we have drifted. God forgive me, my Irish father would probably be turning in his grave tonight to know I'm going to quote a British prime minister. But I will quote Margaret Thatcher. She and her husband, when she was the Prime Minister of Great Britain, she and her husband came to this country quite frequently during the Reagan administration, and they became very close friends of the Reagans. When the Reagans left Washington and went home to California, the Thatchers still came every summer and spent their summer vacation with the Reagans in California. So that gave her a kind of awareness, a kind of insight into us as a nation. And this is what Margaret Thatcher said. "You Americans, you fascinate me. You mention God in every single one of your public documents, but you are not allowed to mention God in your classrooms." Secularism. And so we take up this topic this week, the call to a virtuous way of life. It's not just Judeo-Christian, although I'm basing these reflections in the history and the Judeo-Christian, but we find this even in Aristotle. And we find this even in the Far East, in the philosophers, in Hinduism, in Shintoism, and Buddhism, this call to live a life that has integration, this call to live a life of goodness, this call to live a life of decency and treating other people with decency and inviting all of us to belong to one another. All of this is part of this call to a virtuous way of life. Having made all of those preliminary prefatory comments, then let's spend what's left of our time here tonight simply addressing the most fundamental of all the virtues, and that is the virtue of love. And where do I go to get the foundation for that statement? I turn to the writings of St. Paul, who says, and you are all familiar with this, in the end, he said, there are three great virtues. What are they? Faith, hope, and love. And having said that, he pushes it further and says, but the greatest of the three is love. This is the fundamental virtue upon which all of the other virtues that we will be looking at tomorrow night and Wednesday, this is where they find their foundation. But here is the problem, and I think you would agree with me, that the notion of love that is presented in the Word of God, in our Judeo-Christian tradition, the understanding of love is a countercultural reality to the notion and understanding of love that we find in the culture. The notion of love in this culture is very superficial, to the point that television gives us each year two programs, one in the fall and one in the spring, called The Bachelor and what? The Bachelorette. I always get the two seasons confused. And I must tell you, I don't waste my time watching them, except for the opening evening. In the fall, maybe I'm wrong about this, but in the fall, it's a stable of studs trying to impress one young woman to maybe even marrying him. And in the spring, it's the opposite. And particularly when the women are choosing a possible soulmate or life mate, I watched that evening because these incredibly gorgeous young women climb out of the limousines on the first evening of the program, and their names, just their first names, are flashed across the bottom of the screen, but under their name, we are informed about what they do for a living. And we find out that these young women, they are real estate moguls. They are university professors. They are brilliant teachers in our grade schools. They are physicians and attorneys and business leaders. It's all flashed across the bottom of the screen underneath their names. And in the course of the season, you see these brilliant, gifted young women making absolute fools out of themselves in the hopes that a questionable Italian prince would choose them, or an Argentinian polo player would choose them. The notion is that love can be found in the one season on a television program. It cheapens the whole notion of love. And not only that, but you will remember a number of years ago, a man and a woman who never met each other before met one evening on a television set and got married that night. So that the understanding of love in the culture is a kind of throwaway experimental sort of affair. And then we turn, and this is the point to be made tonight, we turn to the scriptures, we turn to the Judeo-Christian tradition that tells us that love is the fundamental virtue, but Paul describes what the nature of love is in the Judeo-Christian tradition. And what is it? Love is patient. Love is kind. Love is never puffed up and arrogant. Love is long-suffering. You're not going to find that statement on a greeting card for a wedding. What you're going to find is a beautiful young couple skipping through a field of flowers, photographed through a gold lens, with a statement on the inside of the card from someone like Helen Steiner Rice, and the statement is so sticky with sentimentality that you can't even open the card. Love as a virtue is the foundational virtue of all the other virtues, and it requires so much effort, so much engagement, so much hard work. And that is not the cultural understanding of love. And so our young people, they're exposed to all of that commercialization of love, which cheapens it and demeans it and makes it something ridiculous. And so they come to us and we get them ready for marriage. And so many of them have such a difficult time because they've read too many bride magazines and have a very idealistic and romantic notion of love, especially in marriage. And the first time that they have a problem, they wash their hands of the marriage and they throw in the towel and they walk away. But where did they go? Home to mommy and to daddy, who take sides and make the thing even 10 times worse. What this couple need to be told is you're going to go back and work this out with the person that you have married. And if this ends in divorce, then it ends in divorce. But it's not going to be something that you're running away from. It's going to be something that you have resolved. Because it's so important for them to understand that they both have planted seeds of destruction in that marriage, and those seeds will be planted in secondary marriages and tertiary marriages and on if they do not come to terms with what they contributed to the breakup of that first marriage. And this is not Simeon Gallagher's personal social analysis. Every year, the federal government releases sheets of statistics, and the statistics tell us that over 50% of first marriages in this country end in failure. Clearly, there's something going on. And I think that often it's a failure to understand that if you enter into something like a serious relationship and you are struggling to love, it's going to entail the issue of surrender. And surrender is not a word that many people want to hear. But there's no progression and there's no serious commitment to any significant way of life if that element of surrender is not present. And it's not just surrender on the day of their marriage or whatever. It's a surrender in which they must engage every single day of the marriage. And it's of essence in any serious commitment. If you have been, for example, in the Roman Catholic community to the ordination of a priest or a deacon or a bishop, one of the components in the ordination service is that this man lies flat on his stomach on the floor of the sanctuary of the church where he's being ordained, as a symbolic statement of his willingness to be surrendered. And while he's lying there, the choir is singing the litany of the saints all around him. asking God to send the help of all these holy women, these holy men from the Old Testament, from the New Testament, the history of the church and the saints upon saints. Pray for him! Pray for him! Because it's all about surrender. And when he comes up off of his gut, because he presumably has that surrendered attitude, it shouldn't make any difference to him whether the archbishop sends him to the worst parish in the Archdiocese of Denver or sends him to Our Lady of Loretto, which of course is the best parish in the Archdiocese, because he surrendered and it doesn't make any difference. It's all about surrender. Love is patient. Love is kind. Love is long-suffering. And that is not the nature of love presented by the culture. If I were to finish here tonight, I would say that there are two significant characteristics that emerge from the scriptures with regard to this issue of love. And I want all of us to see the importance of this fundamental virtue, because all the other virtues don't make sense if they're not the, so to speak, exfoliation and the progression of the fundamental virtue of love. And the first of these two characteristics is that love takes a long, long time to be discovered and to grow. A long, long time to fall in love. A long, long time to grow in love. And I don't say this off the top of my head because I learned this from my own mother and my own father. You heard me say in the homily at the masses over the weekend, my parents came from Ireland. They didn't know each other at home, but they met in Philadelphia at an Irish dance and they fell in love. And are you ready for this? They courted for 12 years before they got married. I remember saying to my mother one time, Mom, 12 years? And she said, I wanted to be sure. Of course, they were immigrants, and they had no money. And marriage, yes, at one level, it is a sacrament, it is a beautiful statement of romance and everything, but at another level, it's a business deal. It needs to be economically solid. And they waited all those years with the little jobs and so forth that they had in order to create that economic base so that there was no threatening of the marriage because of fiscal irresponsibility. It took them a long time. I don't want to sound like a jaded old priest, but I do not believe in love at first sight. I believe in lust at first sight. It takes a long, long time to discover love, to deepen love, to become loving toward another person. And that's perfectly clear, is it not, in the Judeo-Christian tradition? It's not a fly-by-night experience. It's not an experiment that if it doesn't work, we can get an annulment or a divorce and start all over. It's a very serious statement of surrender. I belong to you. You belong to me, and you can count on me to be here when you come home in the evening. It takes a long time to develop. And here is the second characteristic, and then I'll stop. Love always demands self-sacrifice. It always demands this issue of surrender. Love is long-suffering, Paul tells us in his letter to the Corinthians. And oddly enough, can I share something with you? I'll be 50 years a priest in August. I don't know how many couples down through those 50 years I have married, but many of the brides, in fact, three quarters of the brides when they choose the scriptural passages for their wedding service, their wedding, they always choose that passage, love is patient, love is kind. Oddly enough, they have it read in the church as part of their wedding ceremony, but they forget it before they get to the reception because it's so difficult to keep a handle on all of this stuff. But it always entails self-sacrifice. The gradual development of love, even in the life of a priest. Why not? Because marriage and holy orders are the two sacraments of love. I, as a priest, am supposed to look at you who are married couples and see your generosity, your unselfishness, and learn from your example how to become that kind of a priest with the people to whom I have been sent in service. And you, as married couples, should be able to see in those of us who are priests generosity of spirit, extravagance of service, so that your own service to each other can be deepened by the example of a good priest. These two sacraments of holy orders and marriage are the sacraments of love. And it always entails self-sacrifice. And where in the name of heaven am I getting that idea from? Can I ask you to look at the magnificent icon of the crucifixion that's hanging from the ceiling right behind me? You cannot look at a crucifix and not realize that this is a statement of total self-donation. He gave everything, including his own life, for the sake of you and me, so that salvation would be available to us by his very self-donation. And that crucifixion, and it's not coincidental that that form of self-donation is presented on a crucifix, because it is extremely difficult to grow in a relationship with another person, or me as a priest to grow in relationship to the people with whom I'm sent in service, in a willingness to sacrifice my life. It's long-suffering, self-sacrifice, and self-denial. Now, thanks be to God, we are not left without solid contemporary examples, even in our American culture, of precisely these kinds of people. I'm thinking of young Pat Tillman, who sacrificed a lucrative career as a football player with the Arizona Cardinals because after 9/11, he felt compelled to give something back to the nation for all that the nation had given to him. And he decided to become an Army Ranger. And he lost his own life, tragically enough, in friendly fire. Willing to make that sacrifice. I'm thinking of an African-American gentleman by the name of Wesley Autry, who years ago was standing on a subway platform in Manhattan with his two little twin girls, one in each hand, and he looked down the platform and saw someone falling off of the platform onto the tracks as the subway was rushing toward him. He shoved the two little girls back against the wall and jumped onto the track and covered this man's body with his own body. Thanks be to God, the well between the tracks was deep enough that the train passed over the two of them. And George Bush, in his last State of the Union address as our president years ago, had Wesley Autry up in the gallery, and he pointed to this man and said, "This is what America is all about. It is a willingness to sacrifice your own life, if that is necessary, for the well-being of the common good. This is America. Look at this man, he said. And he said that that self-sacrifice is rooted into a correct understanding of the American DNA. We are given wonderful examples. I'm sorry that I don't remember the names of these three gentlemen, but you will remember that they were on a train in France. Two of them were active military, one of them was retired. They were no more than 27 or 28 years of age, and they were in these cabins on the French railroad, and one of them saw someone coming down outside of all the cabins with a high-powered pistol, and he realized that this was going to be turned into an act of terrorism, and he marshaled the help of his two buddies, and they were able to tackle the guy, even though one of them was wounded. It was an act of self-sacrifice to save the lives of all of those people on the trains, and thanks be to God, the government recognized them because Barack Obama, who was the president at that time, entertained them in the White House and said pretty much the same thing that George Bush said. This is what America is all about. We think less of ourselves and more of other people so that we can be of service. It's a virtuous, virtuous way of doing life. And that's enough for this evening. Aren't you happy? I'm tired listening to myself talk. So let's just sit for a moment quietly with a little bit of music playing in the background. At this time in the past, outside of COVID, we would have a collection, but we're not doing that tonight. There are collection baskets or boxes in the back. What I would suggest is that if you're going to be with me in the course of the week, on the last night that you know it'll be the last night, then put something into the box. I need to bring something home. Otherwise, they won't let me come back. But put something into the box. And if you were making checks out, make them out to the parish. Don't make them out to me. And then all of this will be collated at the end of the week. And those of you who are watching by live stream and will be benefiting from the reflections and so forth in the course of this week, I'd ask you to be kind enough to just simply put a contribution by the end of the week into an envelope, a check or whatever, and mark mission either on the bottom of the check or on the outside of the envelope, and somehow manage to get that here to the parish offices so that we can all contribute at least financially to the work of the Capuchins in the many ministries that we have, particularly here in Colorado. So let's just sit quietly and then we'll conclude. Think about what we've shared tonight, and was there one point that struck home? Was there one point that I need to take to heart? Let's just sit quietly for a moment. So our final prayer tonight doesn't need to be too complicated. Can I ask you to rise and pray the Lord's Prayer with me? Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. May the Lord bless you and keep you. May he turn his face to you and have mercy on you. May he show you his countenance and grant you his peace. In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen.